This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, June 20th, 2006. June 9th, President George Bush issued this statement. At 6:15 p.m. Baghdad time on June 8th, Special Operations Forces, acting on tips and intelligence from Iraqis, confirmed Abu Musab Zarqawi's location and delivered justice to the most wanted terrorist in Iraq. In other words, military forces killed the terrorist al-Zarqawi. Today on Taking Aim, Part 2 of Wag the Villain, the U.S. invention of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Two 500-pound bombs created a crater 40 feet wide. Then special forces came in and bulldozed the site. But was the man they caught, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the man who lived 52 minutes after the high-powered bombs burst the lungs and flung and destroyed all the other people there? Was this Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, called by President Bush the most wanted terrorist in Iraq? Ralph?
Maya, the website Apostates of Islam has been reproduced here. I say reproduced because a posting on January 23rd of 2006 reproduces the posting that Apostates of Islam had put out in February of March 2004. Al-Zarqawi died. Iraq militants declare al-Zarqawi is dead, March 4th, 2004. And this is reproduced at the time on MSNBC. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in the Salimaniya Mountains of northern Iraq during the American bombing there, according to a statement circulated in Fallujah this week and signed by the leadership of Allahu Akbar Mujahideen. Al-Zarqawi was unable to escape the bombing because of his prosthesis, because he had one leg and could not move with any alacrity, and died in this bombing. This is the report put forward by his own nominal movement and confirmed and at the time authenticated by MSNBC. And then MSNBC, Iraq militants declare al-Zarqawi is dead. A Jordanian extremist suspected of bloody suicide attacks in Iraq was killed in a U.S. bombing. And a letter outlining plans for fomenting sectarian war is a forgery. The statement from an insurgent group west of the capital said that this is MSNBC on March 4th, 2004. Two critical points. Al-Zarqawi died and was killed in a U.S. bombing attack. And the group that had been supposedly affiliated with him, an insurgent group, declares that a letter ascribing to al-Zarqawi about fomenting sectarian war and attacking the Shiites is a forgery. In other words, it is a U.S. invention. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in the Salimaniya Mountains of northern Iraq during the American bombing there. Again, this is a statement signed by the entire leadership of the Allahu Akbar Mujahideen. He was unable to escape because of his artificial leg. Before the Iraq conflict began last March, MSNBC continues, on March 4, 2004, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell stated al-Zarqawi received hospital treatment in Baghdad after fleeing Afghanistan. U.S. intelligence sources stated he was fitted with an artificial leg. And this statement, and this is again MSNBC reporting, the fabricated al-Zarqawi memo has been used by the United States to back up their theory of a civil war in Iraq. Now, the Mujahideen statement says al-Qaeda is not present in Iraq. Al-Qaeda is not present in Iraq. And at the same time, the MSNBC report acknowledges that in a German court last year, Shadi Abdallah, a Palestinian on trial for allegedly plotting to attack Berlin's Jewish museum and a Jewish-owned disco, testified he was working for al-Zarqawi, but in fact, the event was ascribed to al-Zarqawi and has been disclosed, as were a series of such attacks in Germany, as being a Mossad operation like that of the Berlin disco. We are very clearly in the presence of the paradigm of the false flag operation.
Well, now we have for months a team of the Delta Force, the British SAS, and other special forces hunting for al-Zarqawi. And here we have the decision to drop two 500-pound bombs, the GBUs, what we were used to call the 500-pound bombs, the JDAMs, that create this huge crater, such a crater, 40 feet wide, destroyed everything in its place. And yet, they say that one of the individuals wearing black robes, who they contend the DNA they've identified, I don't know how they have Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's DNA, but they say that by identification, that he survived for 52 minutes, but that he died by the damage to his lungs, fatal injuries caused by shockwaves from the explosions. Now, what's interesting is that the body of this man, while he was still alive, was pulled from the rubble by neighbors of the house. The people had the house had been sold recently, and people had moved in 10 days ago, and that a man in the black robes had been pulled from the rubble, and the man, Mohammed, who lived near this building, told the Associated Press Television News that he witnessed Americans beating the man in the black robes, who the U.S. military states is Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, that they stomped on his stomach and chest until he died and blood came out his nose. Now, this is not just one statement from this Iraqi. An Iraqi police lieutenant, and the Iraqi police were the first on the scene, said that he was among the first people there, and he told the Times, the Los Angeles Times reporter, that Iraqi police had carried Zarqawi to an ambulance on a stretcher, that U.S. troops took him off the stretcher, placed him on the ground. One of the Americans tried to question Zarqawi and repeatedly stepped on his chest, causing blood to flow from his mouth and nose. We have two independent reports of military abuse murdering the man who was pulled from the rubble, who may or may not have died anyway from the extreme pressure and damage that's caused to the lungs from these huge 500-pound bombs.
Well, Maya, the death of al-Zarqawi, which we should look at with some care here, is very clearly not what the authorities have represented it to be, if indeed this is al-Zarqawi, which, as we have shown, cannot be the case. First of all, al-Zarqawi was a short, stocky man, and the body that was presented was neither short nor stocky. Secondly, al-Zarqawi was covered with tattoos, and the initial reports from eyewitnesses, both the Iraqi police and the people who found the body, are that there were no telltale tattoos.
And these are tattoos on his hands, not just tattoos on the body.
No, that's right. There are no tattoos reported by those who found this person. Secondly, the force of these two 500-pound bombs was such that it melted all of the steel in the roof, totally disintegrated the houses, and blew apart the 5 to 7 people in their bodies, the women and the children, the child, so that there was nothing but pieces of flesh remaining. And here you have a person who is unmarked. And the Los Angeles Times report on January 11th is very clear. Questions remained about Zarqawi's final minutes. The United States denies accounts stating that the terrorist was beaten by American troops before he died. 3 days after Zarqawi was killed, the U.S. military brought a group of reporters to see the slabs of concrete and twisted metal that are all that remain of the house. American troops who combed through the debris and left the more mundane items, a child's shoe, a torn page of a copy of the Arabic language of Newsweek, a threadbare leopard print slip. And briefing with reporters, Army Major General William Caldwell IV said the two doctors had been brought to Iraq to conduct an autopsy to determine the exact cause of al-Zarqawi's death. And here is the Los Angeles Times after first reporting Zarqawi was dead, U.S. troops arrived. Finding Zarqawi wounded, they put him on a stretcher, according to accounts from Iraqi police and U.S. military officials. U.S. officials denied that Zarqawi was systematically abused by U.S. troops. An Iraqi police lieutenant, however, who was among the first people at the scene, told the Times on Saturday that U.S. troops took al-Zarqawi off the stretcher, placed him on the ground, and repeatedly stepped on his chest, stomped him, causing blood to flow from his mouth and nose, said the lieutenant, who spoke on condition of anonymity. Further, man identified as Muhammad, who lived near the Zarqawi hideout, told Associated Press, "I witnessed Americans beating Zarqawi. They stomped on his stomach and chest until he died, and blood gushed from his nose," he said. The report in the Los Angeles Times is then confirmed by CBS. In the CBS account, the same information is presented with respect to the witnesses. So the figure who has supposedly been blown up in a house from which nothing remains except body parts is, in fact, there on a stretcher and stomped to death. Was he brought there? Was he ever in that building? One thing is for sure, that the man who they call al-Zarqawi bears no physical resemblance to the person that we have been presented with over the years as al-Zarqawi. And indeed, we have to go back at this point. We will come back to the presumptive death and the way the U.S. has handled it. I should mention, by the way, in that regard, that the report by the World Socialist website, Kate Randall and Barry Gray, is very apposite. There's something not only politically odious but psychologically perverse in the lurid and manic response of the United States government and media to the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The exultation in his demise, replete with gruesome photos of the corpse plastered across newspapers, displayed on TV screens, has an almost ritualistic character. The killing of Saddam Hussein's sons and the capture of the former Iraqi president evoked a similar official response. President Bush was, quote, thrilled when he got the news, and he was evidently coached to contain his euphoria when he went before the cameras to announce the, quote, good news. But the media evinced no such restraint. "Gotcha," was the front page headline on Friday's New York Post tabloid, atop a full page photo of a dead man's scarred face lying in a pool of blood. The inside headline reads, "Evil Zarqawi blown to hell." The New York Daily News exclaimed, "Picture perfect. Terror boss blown right to hell." And there is a U.S. soldier holding a large framed copy of the same photo, and the, quote, respectable, unquote, New York Times ran a banner headline, a spectacle, which bespeaks, as the World Socialist website says very appositely, the mindset of the American ruling class, what it seeks to inculcate among the public at large. The ruling establishment's outlook is primitive, backward, and self-delusionary, a childish belief that it can extricate itself from the disaster it has created, and its purpose is to kill another 5,000, 10,000, or 100,000 people. Indeed, that is
They will go to no length to control Congress. That's right. They will go to any length. And with approval ratings that had plummeted to 33% and have only crept up to 39% in the last Gallup poll in June, July is coming up, and President Bush needed something. He needed something. The Republican Party needed something. And given the mass disaffection of the military in Iraq and what is being now reported of desertions and the refusal to reenlist, they are in trouble. They are in deep trouble.
This was celebrated not just by Bush, but by all the leaders of the Democratic Party, and their from Al Gore to Joseph Biden, declared their full approval and satisfaction. Indeed, they were no less gloating and celebratory and obscenely obsessed with the details of the devastated body than were the White House and its spokespersons. Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Was it coincidence? At the very outset of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, rumors were presented by the United States military that an al-Zarqawi attack on American soil was imminent. Al-Zarqawi was identified by CNN as the lone wolf planning terrorist attacks simultaneously in several countries. This is right after Abu Ghraib. And then immediately after the revelations of the Abu Ghraib torture, systematic torture of Iraqi prisoners, when Bush was being confronted with a demand to apologize, came, quote, the mysterious video on the Nicholas Berg execution, a mysterious tape released by CNN at the same time pointed to al-Zarqawi's plan to attack the Jordanian intelligence headquarters using chemical weapons which would be more deadly than 9/11. CNN, April 27th. John Vaz, Jordanian Special Forces raiding an apartment house in Amman in the hunt for an al-Qaeda cell. There's a bold plan to use chemical weapons and truck bombs in the capital, targeting Jordanian intelligence headquarters, the Prime Minister's office, and the U.S. Embassy. The death toll will run into the thousands, more deadly even than 9/11. Aired on Jordanian TV, CNN obtains copies of the tapes from the Jordanians. The man revealing the plans and terrorist plans and revealing that his orders came from al-Zarqawi is a person named Azmi Jaizuzi, the cell's alleged ringleader. Now, what's interesting about this is the following. Azmi Jaizuzi is quoted by CNN. I took advanced explosive courses in poisons high level when I pledged allegiance to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And John Vaz of CNN acknowledges al-Jaizuzi has marks on his hand, neck, and face. The Jordanians who taped the confession stated that he suffered the injuries during his arrest. This man was tortured savagely by the Jordanian intelligence services and then produced for CNN to make this attribution to Zarqawi. CNN quoted this man and Jordanian authorities that the attack would involve a combination of 71 lethal chemicals, including blistering agents to cause third-degree burns, nerve gas, and choking agents, which would form a lethal toxic cloud over a square mile of the capital, Amman. Thousands would die in al-Qaeda's deadliest terrorist attack. Then Associated Press reports on that Monday that they had been, the men who were being accused of preparing this were recruited by al-Zarqawi to carry out the first suicide attack to be launched by al-Qaeda using chemicals striking at Jordan and Hashemite royal family and launching a war. And al-Jaizuzi, the tortured prisoners, produced to say he received $170,000 from al-Zarqawi to buy 20 tons of chemicals. And then they produced images of vans packed with chemicals and explosives, as reported in the Charleston Post-Courier. And now, within 2 weeks, on 11th of May 2004, al-Zarqawi is reported as the mastermind behind the execution of Nicholas Berg on May 11th, 2004. Perfect timing. The report coincides with the call by U.S. senators for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign over Abu Ghraib. It occurs a few days after Bush's apology for the Abu Ghraib abuses on May 6th, and the Nicholas Berg video serves to create, quote, a useful wave of indignation to distract and soften up public opinion following the release of the pictures of torture of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib.
Well, Ralph, let's discuss the Nicholas Berg beheading and the particular videotape. Nicholas Berg, a young man, 26 years old, U.S. citizen, had traveled in Iraq. He had visited from December 2003 to January 2004, and then again starting on in March of 2004. Supposedly, he was looking for electrical contracting work, building radio towers, that is, the cell phone towers. On March 24th, Iraqi officials arrested Berg, supposedly Iraqi officials arrested Berg, at a checkpoint in Mosul and jailed him. And the Washington Post stated that perhaps this is because he had a Jewish last name and an Israeli stamp in his passport. On April 5th, the family of Nicholas Berg filed suit in a federal court in Philadelphia, contending that their son was being held illegally by the U.S. military. And the next day, April 6th, Nicholas Berg supposedly was released. And on Saturday, May 8th, Berg's body was found outside of Baghdad on a highway overpass. And 3 days later, on May 4th, 2004, a video of Nicholas Berg's execution, supposedly by beheading, was posted on Muntada al-Ansar website, which is no longer on the Internet. Now, there's quite a bit of confusion about whether he was held by the Iraqis, who deny that, or by the U.S. military, who also deny it. However, the Berg family had an email from Beth A. Payne, a U.S. consular officer in Iraq, that, this is what Payne said, the U.S. military was holding Berg had been for 13 days.
We have to keep in mind what this is really about. Nicholas Berg is a supporter of the war, a supporter of Bush, and associated with the United States government.
But his father isn't.
His father, Michael Berg, on the contrary, is an opponent of the war. The family has been a very principled critic of U.S. imperialism and of the invasion of Iraq. His son is another story. Nicholas Berg was, in fact, not only associated with U.S. intelligence, but appears at Norman, Oklahoma, where he is being trained in a flight school owned by Warren Buffett, and interestingly enough, as we have discovered and we reported on Taking Aim, Nicholas Berg shared a computer password with none other than Zacharias Moussaoui. Now Nicholas Berg, we are told, is wandering Iraq because he's looking for work as an electrical engineer across Iraq. He is, in fact, held by the United States military. As you say, Beth Payne is the U.S. consular officer in Iraq, and she officially acknowledged that he was held by the United States military in custody. Dan, senior spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq, then said, well, Berg was arrested and held by the Iraqi police, but the Iraqi police deny this and state no, in fact, he was held by the United States military in their control, in their custody, which is what is confirmed by the consular official. So here you have Nicholas Berg in the control and in the custody of the United States authorities.
Ralph, her quote, and this is from the email that was sent April 1st. She's a U.S. consular officer. in Iraq, and it's, quote, "I have confirmed that your son Nick is being detained by the U.S. military in Mosul. He is safe. He was picked up approximately 1 week ago. We will try to obtain additional information regarding his detention and a contact person you can communicate with directly," end quote.
Well, Maya, let's look at the circumstances. Berg has an Israeli stamp in his passport. He is supposedly wandering Iraq, but we find that the FBI made three specific visits to Berg while he was in custody in Iraq. So the FBI is monitoring and in command of this situation. This is an intelligence operation, and indeed that's what the emerges out of the lawsuit that the family has launched against the United States, and. As we said, Beth Payne had confirmed, your son Nick is being detained by the U.S. military in Mosul. He was picked up approximately 1 week ago. We will try to obtain additional information. So we have no question here that he is in the control of the United States military. And now he next is shown in a video, but before that, his headless body is found near Mosul on May 8th.
Well, let's look at the discrepancies in this video, and the video attributed to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group. But not only that, according to the U.S., Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is the man beheading Nicholas Berg.
Maya, the videotape of Nicholas Berg and his decapitation show him wearing the orange jumpsuit of U.S. issue, identical to the jumpsuits used at Guantanamo and furthermore used at Abu Ghraib. There is strong indication, by the way, from the color of the walls in the video that this is, in fact, Abu Ghraib, the location where the video is taking place. There is no blood at the decapitation, at the time of the decapitation. He is still alive at this point. The cut starting at the front of the throat would have caused blood to be spraying everywhere. And then his severed head and the floor and his clothes and even the hand of the Arab who decapitates Berg have no blood on them. Berg does not move. He is limp before the beheading. It is clear that this man is either drugged or dead. Any person would try instinctively to wiggle or writhe away from a captor's grip and the use of a knife. He may have been dead before the beheading. The lack of spurting blood, the lack of movement, surgeons have testified that this is an impossibility. He was undoubtedly killed before the staged beheading. The cut on the neck is too straight to have done crudely and with such speed by a man wielding a large knife. The chair on which Berg is seated is the exact chair seen in a color photo taken at the Abu Ghraib prison. Standard issue military chair of the United States authorities. The wall and baseboard at the killing site are the same color as those at Abu Ghraib prison. The videotape, of course, is blurred, and indeed the soundtrack that is ascribed to it does not actually marry with the video.
It is out of sync, and also it is obviously spliced together and heavily edited because the date stamps on the video don't coincide. The sequential date stamps are out of sequence. At one point, the tape goes from 2:44:40 to 13:45:47, and that is only in one place, but there are many places
the scream
happens.
The scream is dubbed in. The screaming starts while Berg is not moving and before he's touched. And indeed, it is so amateurishly dubbed. The screaming starts at 4:31, not the time stamp, and about 5 to 6 seconds before Berg is touched and he is moved to his side. While his screaming commences, the head doesn't move and his mouth doesn't move, nor does he appear to be physically screaming. So the audio is playing a loud, vigorous screaming, and the exact same dubbed screaming continues after the long time jump and a time gap with silence. The screaming is clearly dubbed and is incongruous with Berg's lack of activity. This is the most crude dubbing. Tape of speaker and voice and video are totally out of sync. Audio experts note that the tape, quote, is clearly dubbed. The speaker recording is different from the execution of video recording due to the lag between audio and video.
And Ralph, before we continue further with the video, the deconstruction of the videotape of the beheading of the decapitation of Nicholas Berg, we will pause for this station identification. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're listening today to part two. This is the second half of the show of Wag the Villain, the U.S. invention of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And we are in the midst of discussing the videotape of the supposed videotape of the supposed decapitation of Nicholas Berg by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And that leads us to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
Before we do that, Maya, a careful viewing of the video shows that the executioner on several occasions fumbles with the two pages that he holds and is reading the same page over and again. Four times during the video, the executioner is turning over pages, holding the pages apart. There should have been a 2 to 3 second delay in the reading of the documents during the physical handling, but none is found long enough to account for it. The quote, "The executioner is not reading the document, someone else is. The executioner is trying to lip-sync the reading and fails on close inspection." Now, it's interesting because Berg is supposedly going to great trouble to identify himself, providing information about his family. This is recorded before. The scream, it is a woman's scream, not a man's scream.
Ralph, let's go to the issue of, is it Abu Musab al-Zarqawi who is conducting the beheading? And the CIA stated, they confirmed, that the interrogation, that the beheading was done by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Yet, interpreters across the world have said that the voice of the person who's doing the alleged beheading is not does not have a Jordanian accent.
No, that's very important.
Doesn't speak with a Jordanian dialect.
Because al-Zarqawi spoke with a very, very distinctive Jordanian dialect and accent.
So the CIA later said that they based their identification on, quote, a probable voice ID of another videotape. So they have no notion, one, of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's voice, and also they are not recognizing the fact that there are distinct dialects, intonations of Arabic as it is spoken throughout the Arab world, and the Jordanian Arabic from different parts of Jordan also would be different. Just as in the United States, speakers from New York or actually from Brooklyn or the Bronx have different accents.
Well, Maya, here's a critical point. There is a change in masks. The guy, the man who holds up the head at the end has a white mask and no vest. The man who pulls out the knife and starts cutting is in a black mask. The only person with a white mask is wearing a green vest. So you have here a scissors and paste job in which the actual physical wherewithal of the perpetrators alters in different parts of the video. Furthermore, al-Zarqawi is missing his one leg. He is supposedly wearing a prosthetic device, and this is on the basis of all prior reports, CIA reports. The International Herald Tribune portrait of al-Zarqawi is full of the detail about the prosthetic device. There is no evidence that the executioner is wearing a prosthetic device. Not only that, they not only brought him back to life, but they grew him a new leg. And it should be pointed out that the boots on this are on this new leg that has so marvelously been regrown by the CIA.
Shoes.
Are Army issue. U.S. Army issue. And, of course, the large green tattooed dots on the back of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's left hand cannot be seen because the figure who is being presented as al-Zarqawi has no such tattoos. and the back of the hand is entirely visible. As the evidence shows, the indigenous sources had confirmed that our Zakawi had been killed by a U.S. helicopter attack months previous to this, precisely because he could not escape the targeted house. And furthermore, there is a gold ring on the killer's hand. He is apparently wearing a gold ring. Now, what's interesting about that is that practice of wearing gold ornaments is discouraged for males by Muslim clerics. Gold is the ornament of women. Socially, it is not acceptable in the Arab world for men to wear gold. This may be changed for young people in metropolitan areas, but certainly not for presumptive religious figures such as al-Zarqawi. The gold that he is displaying is incompatible. And, of course, the...
And Ralph, when the body was returned, the body of Nicholas Berg was brought back to the United States, the U.S. government refused to let the parents view the body.
The family was not allowed the body. The body had been requested. Al-Zarqawi's face is very well known. If he is the perpetrator, why is he masked throughout the entire time in this video? The CIA is identifying the voice as al-Zarqawi, but in fact there is no evidence of that, and the accent belies that claim. And finally, the firearms. The firearms experts have stated that the AK-47 carried by the executioner in this video is a Galil, an Israeli-made weapon. So here you have al-Zarqawi using Israeli issue. the absurdity of this video attribution of the execution and beheading of Nicholas Berg as the work of the al-Zarqawi figure who they have brought back to life and grown a new leg and given a new accent and disappeared his tattoos and provided with army boots from the United States and automatic weapons from Israel. What do they take us for, brothers and sisters?
Well, this was just the first. The Nicholas Berg in May of 2004 was followed with the video executions, the beheading of Americans Eugene Armstrong and Jack Hensley in September, and the Briton Ken Bigley in October of 2004, all attributed by the U.S. military to al-Tawid Wal Jihad, an organization supposedly of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
And this brings us now, Maya, to the article by the very Dexter Filkins, who is the vehicle for disinformation from the Pentagon regarding al-Zarqawi. But on June 11th in the New York Times, at the site of the attack on al-Zarqawi, all that's left are questions. Yes, there is a leaflet from the Council of Holy Warriors, the militant organization that Mr. Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia claimed to have joined. But the bits and pieces scattered Saturday through the ruins in Hihib were the remains of the American airstrike that killed al-Zarqawi and five others. The big hole, sir, said Sergeant Major Gary Rimpley, who reached the scene. The bodies are gone, including the body of the girl. The rubble has been picked over by the military for the most useful bits of intelligence. Everything is taken away. And chief amongst the questions is, how did Mr. Zarqawi, the terrorist leader killed, survive even a few minutes after the attack, as American officers say he did, writes Dexter Filkins in the New York Times? Everything else around was obliterated. The concrete blocks, the walls, the fence, the tin cans, the palm trees, the washing machine, everything at the Hib site was shredded and blown to pieces. It is puzzling, given this destruction and the condition of the other bodies. How was Mr. Zarqawi's head and upper body intact? Mr. Zarqawi had begun to run from the house, according to the Iraqi news media, as the first bomb struck. Yet a military pathologist arrived on the scene to perform an autopsy on the body. What we have here is the clear evidence that that body was not associated with that building and that bombing because it's intact. It is not shredded. It is not devastated or destroyed. They have produced a body and then they stomp it. The article by the New York Times on June 11th.
Which is Dexter Filkins and John Burns.
Yes. Raises the right questions and poses the inevitable conclusion that you cannot reconcile the condition of the body and the witness testimony with the official fiction. And that
Ralph, before we go further, I would like to mention that there are some summary articles that appear on the Internet, one by Michelle Chosudovsky, who was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, that goes into the PSYOPs, which is available at globalresearch.ca. And then also the 50 Fishy Circumstances, Contradictory Claims, and Videotape Anomalies is available at KURO5HIN.org. And it's by Deacon Recon in Politics.
Yes, Michelle Chosudovsky has reviewed much of the evidence. He cites a number of sources, not all of the ones that we have, but sources that are totally consistent with our own. More Holes in the Official Story in Zarqawi's Death is his article. And Michel is always excellent in his adumbration of the evidence. And he reaches the same conclusions that we do, that this is a PSYOPs operation. More Holes in the Official Story on Zarqawi's Death on June 11th by Michel Chosudovsky. And the follow-up piece by Chosudovsky on doubt over Zarqawi's role and the other piece by Michel called Who is Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Pentagon's new terrorist mastermind of June 11th, which is an excellent summary of this material as well. We certainly recommend it, although, as I say, the material that we've cited here today is our own accumulation of evidence, but it's certainly consistent, and we share with Michelle the estimate of what's going on. Here is the Age in Australia, doubt over Zarqawi's role as ringleader, which was republished in the Daily Telegraph in London, and this goes back to October 2nd. And what's important about this article in The Age is that it is by Adrian Blomfield from Fallujah, and the point about this is that the al-Zarqawi attributions are deployed to create the rationale for the destruction of al-Fallujah. It also states in The Age in Australia, American intelligence obtained through bribery has seriously overstated the insurgency role of the most wanted figure in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And we are basically paying up to $10,000 a time to opportunists, criminals, and chancers who pass off fiction and supposition as cast iron fact, making al-Zarqawi a linchpin of just about every attack in Iraq, said one intelligence agent quoted in The Age in Australia. The Australian publication confirms the fabrication about this al-Zarqawi, who they acknowledge is dead.
Ralph, I think we should move on to some of the overall politics that we've been talking about in this program and that we've discussed often on Taking Aim. And there's an interesting article you located by Greg Pallast, Unreported, The Zarqawi Invitation. And it's written, I think, June 11th. They got him, the big bad beheading berserker in Iraq, but something's gone unreported in all the glee over getting Zarqawi, Pallast writes. Who invited him into Iraq in the first place? And he goes on to state, a phone call to Baghdad to Saddam's palace on the night of April 21st, 2003. It was Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on a secure line from Washington to General J. Garner. The general arrives in Baghdad just hours before to take charge of the newly occupied nation. The message from Rumsfeld was not a heartwarming welcome. Rummy told Gardner, "Don't unpack, Jack. You're fired." "My preference," Gardner told Palast in his understated manner, "was to put the Iraqis in charge as soon as we can and to do it in some form of elections."
But Maya, this was the Gardner intention, but it was not, as Palast reports, part of, quote, the plan. And the plan was a 101-page document to guide the long-term future of Iraq. Nothing about elections, rather a schedule for selling off, quote, all of Iraq's state assets, everything, oil and all supporting industries, and especially the oil, quote, unquote. And there was more than oil to set off. The plan, 101 document, included the sale of Iraq's banks and changing its copyright laws. And this, of course, is a program for the wholesale looting of Iraq, which is indeed the purpose of the imperialist agenda of permanent war. This is what they have in mind with the IMF and its privatizations, corporate looting of the nation's assets, and as Palast discovered at the BBC, the elimination of copyright and tax code changes. And by the way, this was being orchestrated for the plan by Jack Abramoff's associate Grover Norquist. Talk about the kleptocracy. Seizing title and ownership of Iraq's oil fields was the fundamental objective of the plan, and Gardner wasn't implementing this. And the most important thing to which the military was objecting, and this brings us into focus, Gardner was brokering a truce between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds in what Gardner called the big tent to hammer out an election date. This would have ended the state asset sell-off plan because no Iraqi government, even a puppet government, could go along with handing over to foreign corporations the entire economy of Iraq.
Because Gardner came in to do what an occupying general would do, which is to stabilize and to institute the local government, which of course would be subordinate to U.S. interests, but would still be the fig leaf of a government. So, who was brought in but Bremer?
And now Paul Bremer is part of the
Kissinger and Associates.
Kissinger and Associates, and he's also part of the Woolsey World War IV plan. He tours with Woolsey, speaking for the neocons and for the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and the American Enterprise Institute. These are the ideologues of 9/11. These are the instruments of the ideological campaign against terror, the false flag operation, which we are describing in this program, brothers and sisters.
And the first thing they institute is exactly what the military had warned shouldn't be done. And there had been the cooperation of Iraqi generals in the fall of Saddam Hussein, where they didn't fight. And the first thing that Bremer does is issue order number one, which is de-bathification, which became effectively de-Sunnification.
Well, what is most important about what Palast points out here, which is completely consistent with what we've been presenting in this two-part program, is that when they replaced Gardner with Bremer, the first thing they did was to link up with the Sunni defending Wahhabi Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in a campaign to, quote, destroy the Shia snakes, unquote. And as for the oil fields, they put out the word about plans to sell off the oil fields. You have here a comment by al-Jubairi. Insurgents are those who want to destabilize a new Iraq. Look, he says, you're losing your country, you're losing your leadership, you're losing your resources to a bunch of wealthy people, a bunch of billionaires in the world who want to take you over and make your life miserable. General Gardner, watching the insurgency unfold, told Palast, I don't think you want to end the day with more enemies than you started with. But you can't have a war, President, without a war, and you can't have a war without enemies. Al-Zarqawi answered the call, Palast concludes quite correctly. That's what we're dealing with here.
And Ralph, another myth that has been prominent in the press and prominent from the administration is the myth of Iraq's foreign fighters. Foremost of them is the, they always say, the Jordanian Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And we went back to an article from September 23rd, 2005, from the Christian Science Monitor, an article by Tom Reagan, The Myth of Iraq's Foreign Fighters. And he says the U.S. and Iraqi governments vastly overstate the number of foreign fighters in Iraq, and particularly that most of them don't come from Saudi Arabia. And this is a report of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. And the report was published in The Guardian in Great Britain, that U.S. and Iraq, quote, feed the myth that foreign fighters are the backbone of the insurgency, when in fact they are 4% of the estimated 30,000 insurgents. And CSIS says of those, Algerians are the largest group, 20%. And these insurgents, the average age, they're youths. They're 17 to 25. They're generally middle class with jobs, the Saudis this is. And they usually had connections with the prominent tribes of Saudi Arabia. They're revolts at the idea of an Arab land being occupied by the United States.
Maya, nowhere is this entire fictive reinvention of the dead al-Zarqawi made more explicit and clear than in the article by Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times in November of 2004 called Zarqawi Bush's Man for All Seasons. You know, I hate to predict violence, but I just understand the nature of the killers, says George Bush. This guy Zarqawi, he's an al-Qaeda associate in Baghdad prior to the removal of Saddam Hussein. Yeah, he was with Saddam Hussein, and he's still at large in Iraq. And part of his operational plan is to sow violence and discord amongst various groups in Iraq by cold-blooded killing. And we need to help find Zarqawi so the people of Iraq can have a more bright future. What did he say on the recent murder of this figure? We want the people of Iraq to have a more bright future. Not a brighter future, says Mortimer Snerd, but a more bright future. And then we find the following in the seminal article by Pepe Escobar in Asia Times in November 2004. Former U.S. Central Intelligence Agency asset turned Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi is set to give the go-ahead to what the U.S. Army twice could not bring itself to carry out, the leveling of Fallujah. Now, the predicate for the leveling of Fallujah is that the figure of al-Zarqawi is to be used as the pretext. Indeed, it is said that he is operating out of Fallujah, and consequently, the control of the city of 300,000 is in the hands of al-Zarqawi. So unless they hand over Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is already dead, the United States will devastate and destroy al-Fallujah. Al-Zarqawi is the pretext for the devastation of al-Fallujah by the U.S. military, a plan long in preparation. And indeed, the full weight of the Bush administration is involved in inventing al-Zarqawi as the al-Qaeda leader. Cheney insists that al-Zarqawi is the key figure. And indeed, as the article states, Zarqawi had no connection either with bin Laden or with Saddam Hussein. Secular Saddam hosting the Islamic radical in the American campaign against the axis of evil has reached a fever pitch is a ludicrous proposition. And this piece is so explicit in demonstrating that everything imaginable and Iraq and elsewhere has been attributed
to Ralph, what's the date of the piece? Al-Zarqawi.
It's November 2004. There is no shortage of documentation in print and online on how the U.S. intelligence agents operating around the world have created and developed their own terrorist groups, their own terrorist warnings, their multi-billion-dollar tactics, including black psyops, to neutralize the groups that they created in the first place. And he says, will the real Zarqawi please stand up? The master disguise with the bogus identification papers, always eluding the efforts of a multi-billion-dollar U.S. intelligence machine, the evil personified as a non-starter. He has been created by U.S. military intelligence. He is a Hollywood improvement in the on the original, tall, urbane, highly articulate with agile legs. Zarqawi is a creation, he documents in this piece in 2004, November.
Ralph, to conclude, on these, in this past Sunday, two Sundays ago, there was a big graphic, AQIZ, that's for the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the degradation since January 2005. It's a huge chart that's prepared by the military of how they've killed or captured so-called terrorists, and it has Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, and of course Al-Zarqawi is considered Tier 1. And as we speak, there is this huge development in Baghdad of the military sweeping through Baghdad, and in Ramadi, the city is cordoned. There have been massive airstrikes, a huge humanitarian crisis. There are no services, no food or water, and people are blocked from fleeing. 400,000 people are trapped in the crossfire. Food and medical supplies running low, and municipal services have ground to a stop. It is a repeat of what took place in Fallujah, the devastation of Fallujah.
And what is going to unfold in Ramadi, Maya, as in Fallujah, which required the invention of Al-Zarqawi, is most clearly expressed in the Salvador option in the Newsweek of January 14, 2005. Special forces leading assassination and kidnapping teams. What do we do about the deepening quagmire of Iraq? The Pentagon's latest approach is called the Salvador option. The Salvador option means secret staging of attacks by death squads of the United States. It was done in Vietnam with the Phoenix program. It was done in Salvador, Scott Ritter, in the Salvador option. By any standard, the American occupation is a disaster. Death squads, attacks on ethnic communities orchestrated by the United States. More than 6,000 corpses in Iraq in 5 months, the result of death squad operations attributed to demonic others. Deutsche Press on June 5th of 2006, brothers and sisters.
Ralph.
And finally, Maya, we conclude with the following. The Guardian report on June 12th. United Nations reports accuse Afghan MPs of torture and massacres. Over 18 months, the Central Intelligence Agency and the Afghan MPs carrying out torture and massacre across Afghanistan attributed to Taliban and to the likes of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. This is the hand of the murder state, brothers and sisters. Their invention of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, wagging the villain, is designed to terrorize us all.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program, Wag the Villain, the U.S. invention of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, is available on our website, www.takingaim.info, and on the WBAI website, www.wbai.org. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.